Welcome to another episode of the Students Talk Security Podcast. I'm Anne Griffin, a sophomore in the Notre Dame International Security Center, studying Arabic and Applied Math. Today, I'd like to welcome Professor Kalanick from the Notre Dame Political Science Department. She primarily researches international security, coercive diplomacy, energy politics, and U.S. grand strategy. Professor Kalanick is particularly an expert on how energy and oil shapes international politics. Professor Kalanick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So before we launch into discussion, I would like to give listeners a little bit of a sense of your field and how you became interested in energy politics and oil.
When I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, getting a PhD in political science, I needed to come up with a dissertation topic. And the dissertation is in the capstone experience when you're studying for a PhD. It's an independent research project. And I was casting about for topics. My original topic was something like, why do great powers make mistakes? Which this was only a few years after the Iraq War started. Okay. So it was sort of pertinent in my mind. But it turns out it's really hard to figure out what is a mistake, you know, ex ante as opposed to ex post to really sort of say. So I had to scrap that. And I was trying to think of a new idea. And it occurred to me that oil was in the news a lot. At that time, oil prices were high, relatively high. This is circa 2008, 2009. There hadn't been a lot of research on oil and international politics since the 70s and 80s, since the big oil shocks of those eras. So I thought I would do a dissertation that looked at oil as a coercive weapon. I know of various projects where professors have looked at a particular coercive strategy and tried to figure out, is it effective? Is it not effective? And so it started out as, I want to look at the oil weapon. I want to see if countries can cut off oil to other countries and coerce them into changing their policies. But then when I actually looked into it, I didn't see a whole lot of cases where that occurred. I saw great powers worrying about having oil cut off to them, but it almost never happening. And so that sort of intrigued me more and got me more interested in the topic and led to my first book project, which was about the different types of strategies great powers pursue. So why does a great power like Japan, for instance, circa World War II, go and conquer oil resources, whereas countries like the United States or Britain or France or Germany at various points have pursued lesser measures like alliances or at-home domestic policies like petroleum reserves and that sort of thing. And I liked the topic because it seemed very current, and it wasn't a dead horse that had been beaten over and over and over and over again, right? So it was neat. I had to go and teach myself a ton about energy politics, about some of the economics of energy. And that was really fun and neat and different than what I expected going in.
At the time you were doing your dissertation, there was sort of a lack of scholarship. Has there since been more?
Yeah, there's been a bunch more starting in the early 2010s. Scholarship, there's been a second wave of scholarship looking at energy and oil in particular. Political science stuff, international security topics, they do tend to follow the news to some extent. Mm-hmm. And so we had many years where oil prices were pretty steady. And it wasn't until the 2000s, the mid to late 2000s, that they start really going up and it becomes a topic of conversation again. And I think around the same time, lots of people started getting interested in it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. And you yourself teach a class at Notre Dame on the geopolitics of energy.
I do.
So are there any assumptions that students make about energy politics that you like to debunk at the beginning of the class?
Yeah, well, I debunk it throughout the semester because everyone walks in thinking that they know certain things. And most of the things that we think we know when we start researching the topic are actually wrong. Like I had the same faulty assumptions too. So as an educator, it's totally fun to blow up people's assumptions, in any manner or different ways. So one of the biggest assumptions that people make has to do with energy independence. This narrative waxes and wanes over time, and it has changed since the United States has become no longer reliant on imports for oil. We're actually right around the verge of becoming a net exporter. For the first time in a very, very decades, which nobody really thought would happen again. There's long been this trope or this idea that because the United States relies on oil from the Middle East, or if we get a lot of oil from Saudi Arabia, then Saudi Arabia has some kind of coercive influence over us, mm-hmm. right? And so if we if we drill more at home and increase our oil production at home, then it means we're less sort of under the thumb of other regimes that may or may not like us or might strategically cut off oil or threaten oil cutoffs in order to get us to act certain ways. And that fear is really, from what I can tell, it's based entirely on the 1973 OAPEC embargo and production cuts. So the Organization of Arab Petroleum Exporting Countries, which is a separate organization from the OPEC that we know and love today, which doesn't have the A in there. So it was a subset of Arab OPEC producers, right? But that case actually showed the limits of oil coercion, like of oil's coercive potential. And the historical sort of interpretation of that case, I think is like totally wrong. And many of the things that flow from that are then also subsequently wrong. In fact, oil is actually really difficult to cut off unless you're using military force. The United States and every other country is actually quite secure. The U.S. especially, because we're just the most powerful country in the world. It's not like anybody can physically cut off anything we want to import. You know, we're the ones that can do it to other people, right? So the U.S. is extremely energy secure in that sense. And it also doesn't matter how much oil we produce domestically versus how much we import from somewhere else, because everybody is interdependent as long as they're part of the global oil market.
Okay.
So economists and political scientists sometimes refer to the global oil market as a bathtub with lots and lots of producers, lots of spigots, faucets, lots of drains, right? And oil itself is very fungible. So you can buy oil from Canada or Mexico or Saudi Arabia, and it's a little different in consistency, but not very.
Okay.
And the cost of transportation is really low. So like there's lots of other people you can buy oil from if somebody cuts it off to you, right? And it really doesn't change anything, right? What matters isn't what molecules are coming out of the spigot. Are they the ones ending up in your drain? So once it goes to the global oil market, what matters is how much oil is in the market being traded and whether that supply is going up or down at all, right? So in years where the U.S. was a big net importer, we were paying the global market price for oil, right? Mm-hmm. In years where we're a big net exporter, we are paying the global market price for oil.
Okay.
So it does, like the prices that we pay don't vary depending on how much we produce at home. But the, so that gives us a lot of security. Mm-hmm. The flip side is that if there's some kind of disruption in the market, even if it's not the, the molecules that we import, it still affects the global price. So even if we bought no oil from the Middle East whatsoever, if there was some kind of giant conflict in the Middle East that disrupted oil production, prices would go up for everybody. Right?
Okay.
Now, I don't actually think that those kinds of disruptions are very likely for a whole bunch of other reasons. But the market is much, the market adapts extremely well. It's very, very robust. And it's actually very hard to influence how much oil a country can or cannot consume from the global market,
okay,
unless you're willing to actually just straight up like surround the country and blow up oil that's trying to get in, right?
Okay.
Like if you're blockading a country, you can cut it off. But other than that, there's always somebody that can buy it and resell it to you.
Okay. So then I guess what you're saying is like policy doesn't have a huge impact on like the global oil market, or is that a different?
No, it, I mean, it doesn't have impacts in the way that, that we think that it would. And generally speaking, the impacts are much smaller than we tend to think. If the U.S. and Iran get into a war, which I sincerely hope does not happen for a whole bunch of different reasons and seems not particularly likely at this moment. Mm-hmm. But if the U.S. and Iran got into a war, global oil markets, the oil prices would probably shoot up overnight because people in the market, speculators, people who buy and sell oil for like, or oil futures for investment purposes, right? They would be speculating, they would bid prices up because they would be worried about disruptions, right? And if there was a war, there could be some disruptions. But when that happens, other actors respond, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the U.S. isn't actually really buying Iranian oil now, but if there's less Iranian oil in the market, that does hurt everybody in the market potentially. Swing producers like Saudi Arabia or potentially the fracking people, the hydraulic fracturing people in the US who can increase or decrease supply kind of on the quicker side of things, like they can step in and put more oil on the market and the price disruption then goes away.
Okay.
Right. So even in recent cases where you've seen, so a few years ago, there were these drone attacks on an oil facility in Saudi Arabia called Abqaiq. This was in September of, I'm going to say 2019, maybe it was 2018. Oil prices went way up for a few days because people were worried about Saudi Arabia now can't sell as much oil because one of its facilities got bombed. And within 2 weeks, prices were back to normal and they fixed the whole thing within a month.
Okay.
So it's just like markets just themselves adapt extremely well, just because of price signals, not even because of anything that politicians do, right? But then on top of that, politicians can do additional things to try to speed the adaptation of the market.
So then when we look to like the current conflict in the Red Sea, has that had any kind of influence on disruptions? Because it seems like potentially not, but you know, are there lessons that the international community is like taking away from this conflict as it's blocking trade routes and things like that?
Yeah. So I think the lessons that are being learned are the wrong lessons. So oil transit per se has not been hugely affected. It's more container ships that have been affected. They have an option, right? So they can continue to go through the Red Sea, and a bunch of them have, right? And even though there have been attacks on various ships and, I believe it was a British ship was sunk quite recently. That was the first time that a ship actually was damaged enough that it was unable to continue. And nobody was seriously hurt. Everyone evacuated. It was sort of a controlled thing. Those shippers can just go around the Cape of Good Hope. They can go around Southern Africa, right? And it makes it a longer voyage. It increases the cost a little bit. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about a giant container ship, right, there might be $1 billion worth of cargo on that ship. This might increase transit costs for the whole ship by about $1 million. So that's 1/1,000th of the value of that. Right. So, wow. It's less than 0.1%, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of cost increase. So like, sure. Right. If that container ship has to reroute and go a different way, the cost of that transportation is a little bit higher. But if you like spread that out across all of the goods on that ship being transported, each individual product is tiny, right? It's just tiny. Now, people don't like when things go kablooey, right? And so, you know, there's been a lot of concern about that. But in point of fact, it's had very little impact on prices at all.
Okay.
And if it does have impact on prices, it tends to be more short-term impacts because speculators think, ooh, there's some kind of angle here that I can bet on how long this conflict will go on. And maybe I can buy futures of this or sell futures of that and make some money on the margin, right? But that's sort of, you know, that's the, I tend to think of them as sort of like the charade economy or like the pretend economy, right? Like they're just gamblers, right? They think the price is going to go up or down based on geopolitical reasons, who knows what, right? And so they place different market bets, and some of them do well and some of them don't do well. But aside from that, like in the real economy, like the actual stuff that's showing up at stores, very little difference. Yeah.
Okay. So you talk about like the oil bathtub, like the global bathtub.
Yeah.
It seems like the Arctic Circle is emerging because of global warming, et cetera, as a place where people can, seems like there's a lot of oil there and energy mining and resource extraction and things like that. How does that change the bathtub? Does it at all?
So it doesn't change the bathtub per se. It could potentially expand the bathtub, right? So size of the bathtub varies year on year, but it's somewhere around 90 to 100 million barrels a day. That's the size of the global oil bathtub, right? Like that's the whole market. You know, it might add a few million barrels a day over time.
Okay.
Not a big difference. Developing new resources like the Arctic takes several years, even decades. So this is something that is of increasing interest in a very sort of long-term view, right?
Okay.
Now, in terms of the oil that we know that's out there and the oil that we can access even more easily than the stuff in the Arctic, if we dig all that up and burn it all, we're going to fry the planet long before we've exhausted what we already have, right? So yeah, there's oil there, and people are going to be able to make money from it, and countries care about that. But it doesn't fundamentally alter either the fact that it's a free market and it's a good that's fungible, and so you have this global price, that'll still be the case. And if anything, it'll add potentially more stability, I suppose, to the market just by making it a little bit bigger. But it's not going to like undercut the role of the United States as a major producer or the Middle Eastern countries as major producers. It's not going to like totally change around the sort of center of gravity of the oil market.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously you have like a lot of knowledge on this topic, but is there like a knowledge or perception gap in terms of like, you know, policymakers and politicians, and how does that gap impact what happens on the global stage?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's a huge gap. It's when it comes to oil stuff and energy stuff, it's hard to tell how, like, you know, people are either, they're either being a fool or a knave, right? Like, so there are some folks that I think just genuinely don't understand the oil market, don't understand how it works. And then there are people who do understand, but they would rather pretend that they don't because it's politically useful to make certain arguments, right? And I don't always know where that gap comes from.
Okay.
But yeah, I think that in general, there's a sense of threat inflation and kind of alarmism that is very prominent in Washington, D.C. And, and you know, you have people there that like their job is to study the Arctic. And so to them, the Arctic is the most important place on Earth. And, you know, they can come and give you testimony in Congress about how crucial the Arctic is, right? And, you know, so there are people who care about it or are making arguments about it, but who are not necessarily looking at the bigger picture. And so they might be missing that there's actually a lot of other stuff going on that is potentially more important from a political standpoint and from just an economic standpoint, right? So yeah, there's a gap, and the gap is frustrating. And it's frustrating because I see it in my students, and then I see it in policies that the United States adopts or doesn't adopt that tend to assume much more threatening circumstances than I think really are justified.
Do you have any like policy examples?
Well, I mean, in terms of the Red Sea is a great example, right? Okay. So the United States has spent, I think that the most recent estimate that I saw was something like $15 billion on the operation to protect shipping in the Red Sea since fall. Right. When attacks by the Houthis started in the wake of the giant terrorist attack in Israel. Right. I think if you sat down and looked at how much money it cost in terms of additional transit to reroute versus how much money the United States is paying to try to keep shipping safe, probably it's a loser from a cost benefit situation. Like,
okay,
I suspect we are spending more money. Like we going in and escorting these tankers and then bombing various targets in Yemen to try to send a message to the Houthis and anybody else, like this is probably more costly than the cost to shipping from this conflict.
Okay.
Right. So like, we're spending a bunch of money to save $1 million per giant vessel. You know?
So why do you think they're doing it?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think it's a bunch of reasons, right? So they're worried about larger geopolitical consequences. There's always the worry about reputation. So if the U.S. doesn't do anything about it, will America's enemies think that we won't do anything anywhere? Will they think we're soft, right? That's part of it. There's often a domestic political reason or need or belief that you have to look like you're quote unquote doing something. So like if there are attacks on American soldiers in Jordan, if there are attacks on, you know, American sailors in the Red Sea, and the president doesn't, quote unquote, doesn't do something about it, that looks bad in an election year, right? So there's some of that going on, right? There's a pressure to feel like you're showing that you're doing something, that you're showing that you're being tough. And some of that is just politics. Some of it might be strategic because you're thinking about what message are you sending to Iran? Right? What message are you sending to American allies about whether we will continue to meet our alliance obligations, those sorts of issues. But as a standalone, if you were just looking at the situation, I think it's hard to justify. And the reputational effects, I think, tend to be overstated.
Okay.
Right. That's my personal view, and I could mm-hmm. give you reasons for that. But that's one where I see this big gap, right? In fact, I went to a conference in DC maybe about a month ago, and we were talking about maritime security and maritime vulnerabilities, and the Red Sea came up a bunch, and I and some other folks were trying to make the argument that, well, this isn't really that threatening to the United States. It's not that costly. It's not, and the sort of takeaway lesson wasn't, oh, maybe threats to shipping, maybe our concern about this is overstated. It was, I guess the Red Sea is just different. So maybe mm-hmm. we don't have to be too freaked out about the Red Sea, but we're still going to be freaked out about everything else, right? They're like, oh, okay. You know, like their model, it didn't change their perspective. They just were like, oh, okay, the Red Sea, we got lucky and the Red Sea is not that bad, but oh my goodness, if they started bombing us in other places or attacking shipping in other places, that would be terrible, terrible, terrible. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say it's not bad. I mean, I don't want to see loss of life or destruction of property or anything anywhere. But in the grand scheme of things, it's pretty minor. It's a pretty minor threat.
Okay. Then I guess looking back to the Arctic, the opening of mm-hmm. new shipping routes, how does that influence like U.S. grand strategy? Is it like, should we be threatened? Is that strategic?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to know. And I think that there's a few things that are going on. On the one hand, I don't think the U.S. needs to feel threatened because the U.S. just has, we've got great fundamentals, right? Like we're a big, wealthy country. We have a lot of territory. We have a lot of people. We have the strongest military the world's ever seen. We have nuclear weapons and we're surrounded by oceans. So like, just for all those reasons, we're just a pretty secure country no matter what, mm-hmm. right? More secure than Russia, more secure than China, more secure than most other countries out there. So most things that even if they increase the threat a little bit, you're starting at a really low baseline of threat to the United States, right? For a whole bunch of reasons, the Arctic is not not a place that's easy to operate in militarily, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not like we're going to be worried about people coming over the Arctic after us, right? That yeah. sort of thing. In terms of shipping lanes, you know, as long as we have a really strong Navy, we can defend our shipping. And most of the time we defend the whole world shipping, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if the Arctic melts, knock on wood, that doesn't happen. But if the Arctic's completely melted and the U.S. is still the most powerful Navy, that might actually increase our power because we could say, look, we're the only ones that can guarantee freedom of the commons. Like mm-hmm. we can, if somebody starts threatening shipping in the Arctic, we're the only ones that can really go up there and tell them to knock it off or else, mm-hmm. right? So it's not something that necessarily would challenge American power. The fact that countries seem to be interested in the Arctic, like they're investing more in Arctic military training, Arctic forces, military exercises in the Arctic and whatnot, you know, I don't think at this stage, I think a lot of that is sort of theater. I think a lot of it is status competition, frankly. I mean, within international politics, like I'm a realist, I tend to think that materialism is what matters and states don't necessarily care about status per se. But I don't really have a great material explanation for why countries would be investing more in their militaries in the Arctic because this just it's not that important of a region yet, okay. right? And it's not a place from which major threats to any country are going to come from because no one's going to land in the Arctic and invade from the north, right? I mean, like, that's sort of flippant, but, like, it's true, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, control of the Arctic doesn't matter that much, right? Maybe for economics, but even still. So, you know, I think that they're just engaged in status competition.
Okay.
That, you know, China wants to prove to the world that it's a great power and it's going to be a great power. And so it wants to have its nose in everything, mm-hmm. just like most great powers historically do. So they want to be involved in the Arctic. And, you know, Russia wants to play up its, you know, military power in the Arctic, because it's like one place where it actually looks kind of strong compared to everybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, otherwise it's not doing great in Ukraine, right? So you can be like, yeah, we're the Arctic powerhouse. Like, congrats, Russia. You know, like, have fun up there, you know, right? Yeah. So that's sort of what I think is going on. That's my sense. And it's not something that really threatens American power and could actually even enhance American power because we have such a powerful Navy.
So the appropriate American response would be like to do nothing and at this time?
Yeah.
Because it's not really relevant. Okay.
That's sort of what I think. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that doesn't mean that's what the U.S. will do, because if other powers have military exercises up there and you don't, there's a sort of keeping up with the Joneses kind of logic of like, well, we need to look like we care too. Just, you know, again, for status competition reasons. Mm-hmm. But I don't see a there.
Okay.
Really, in terms of a serious threat or a serious opportunity, for the most part.
Okay.
For the United States.
Okay.
Because again, like, yeah, there's some resources there, but like, we have resources in our country that are cheaper to develop, and so we'll just do that instead.
I had a question earlier about where, I didn't ask it yet, but about like trends in energy politics and like trends in oil, but it kind of seems like there aren't trends, like it's pretty stable.
No, there are. I mean, I guess it depends what you mean by trends. I mean, the market is a global market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oil is sort of what it is, mm-hmm. and the fundamentals of it don't change a ton.
Okay.
And oil, you know, we are embarking on this green energy transition.
Yeah.
Oil is probably going to be the last fossil fuel standing,
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, oil is just so useful for transportation because it's the most energy dense fossil fuel and it's naturally liquid. And so you can put it in tanks and take it with you while you're driving around, right? Like, you can't really do that with natural gas, right? Unless you freeze it, and then it's a lot more expensive, mm-hmm. right? So like, oil is going to be around for a long time, but natural gas and coal and all of that, that's starting to shift, right? I mean, what has happened in the EU since Russia invaded Ukraine has been very interesting from this perspective, right? So Russia spent decades building up a monopoly, not a pure monopoly, but like a pretty strong monopoly, or at least a dominance in natural gas supplies, like as being an exporter of natural gas to Western Europe and Eastern Europe. And they have on purpose built a whole network of pipelines where, you know, originally the pipelines went through several different countries. So there was a pipeline that came through Ukraine that went on to Germany that was super important to Germany. So they built the Nord Stream that bypassed Ukraine, came through the North Sea straight into Germany.
Mm-hmm.
What did that do? It meant that in the future, if they wanted to cut off natural gas to Ukraine, they could still sell it to Germany with the other pipeline, right? So like they've been trying to pit European countries against each other, isolate them, have dominance over natural gas, et cetera. And so the thinking was, when this crisis broke out, that Putin has this implicit threat that he's sometimes made explicit, that Russia could stop selling natural gas to Western Europe,
mm-hmm.
and then Western Europe would cave in and stop supporting Ukraine. And that has not happened.
Yeah, right? Like the flip side has happened.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, first of all, Russia, they reduced the amount of natural gas that they sent, but they didn't stop. And today, all these countries in Western Europe that were buying Russian natural gas, most of them still are.
Mm-hmm.
They're buying smaller quantities. And that was the way that the Russians kind of squeezed them. But natural gas, you have to transport either in pipelines or you have to freeze it. So it is not a bathtub. It's a really different animal than oil.
Mm-hmm.
So the Russians don't have an easy place to turn around and sell it to, because there aren't a bunch of other pipelines going to other places. So like, they still kind of have to sell it to Western Europe, no matter what Western Europe does.
Mm-hmm.
And Western Europe still kind of has to buy it. But they did reduce it. And then in Western Europe, right, you have a bunch of adaptations. So like, people all over Britain, because natural gas prices went up, right, they ran out and bought solar panels and put them on their roofs, right? Because suddenly it was economical to do that, mm-hmm. right? Like, if you're paying a really high natural gas bill, you may as well go out and get the solar panel and save money, right? I don't know if you've been to Britain.
It's not very sunny.
It rains.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, this is a really rainy country, uh-huh. right? Like, Northern Germany, same thing, right? And yet they were like, there was a huge amount of adaptation towards greener energies driven by the increased cost of natural gas, right? And so it had an effect that was kind of surprisingly good from a climate change perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But then by the same token, the US has also seriously increased its LNG, liquefied natural gas exports to Europe. So we've been building more terminals. Like if you want to sell oil, or I'm sorry, if you want to sell natural gas overseas, you have to, you know, you send it in a pipeline to a terminal on a port somewhere. They convert it to liquefied natural gas. So they freeze it so it gets condensed,
okay,
right? So that's dense enough that if you ship it, it's economical to do it. Mm-hmm. And then you have to ship it to a terminal that can regasify it on the other side. So you need these special terminals. You can't just turn around and do it. But over the past 2 years, it's been 2 years now, right? The U.S. has been building up these terminals. Europe has been building up these terminals. And the U.S. has been stepping in. And some Middle Eastern countries, too, have been stepping in and increasing LNG exports to Western Europe. So, like, you didn't see a total cutoff from Russia. B, Western Europe did not capitulate to Russia's demands to stop supporting Ukraine, even when natural gas prices went up. And then, even as natural gas prices went up, right, people shifted to different sources of natural gas or to different sources of energy to compensate for that, right? So, you know, again, it's a different animal than oil. It's potentially more politically potent, mm-hmm. but it also like triggers an adaptation that weakens it over time. So like 10 years or 20 years from now, right, Europe's going to continue going for solar and going for wind and go, you know, all these other sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And they're going to on purpose try to lessen their dependence on Russia in the future. So that in the future they could say, okay, Russia, we don't want your natural mm-hmm. gas, right? Because we don't like your politics. We don't like mm-hmm. what you're doing. So it's totally fascinating and interesting. And it's an important point that few people really realize that different forms of energy, because their physical properties are so different and they're used differently, the politics can be totally different. Like oil and natural gas are lumped in together a lot because they co-occur. Like there are a lot of fuels that produce oil also produce gas, right? And they are priced in a similar, like natural gas is priced partly based on what oil prices are. But they're just used so differently that your ability to cut off or reduce the supply to different people is different, right? Between those two. And that's just totally overlooked, right? Like in the press, they conflate oil and natural gas all the time. And I'll talk about natural gas and oil pipelines, but they're just different animals. Mm-hmm. So that's something that almost nobody understands, even like really well-educated people. People who write for the New York Times, you know, they don't understand that it's different.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
So I feel like I hear a lot about like resource competition in the future and like mm-hmm. natural gas competition, but your take on that is kind of the opposite, where like, it's just not going to matter at all in the future.
Well, I mean, as George Bush famously said, in the long run, we're all dead, right? Yeah. So like, you know, depending on how far in the future you're going, but resource competition is really overplayed.
Okay.
I mean, from no matter what the resource is, mm-hmm. right? We just know in general, there's not, surprisingly enough, there's not a whole lot of conflicts that have been fought over resources, mm-hmm. right? So there aren't a lot of wars fought for oil. There aren't a lot of wars fought for water. There aren't a lot of wars fought for timber or lead or, you know, whatever, whatever things that, you know, lithium or something. It just hasn't caused a lot of conflicts between great powers or even between minor powers historically, right? But yet people have this impression that it has and that it will, right? And, you know, at the end of the day, most of these materials, you're going to have to sell them to someone to make money. And you're going to have to sell them internationally to make money. And mm-hmm. so whoever digs them out of the ground is going to sell them into the world. And once they sell it to somebody, they have no control over where it goes, right? So, you know, there's a lot of concern about rare earth elements and things like, you know, lithium and cobalt and, you know, things that we use in smartphones that also are going to be useful for green energy stuff, that currently China dominates the market for producing those things. To me, it's a total misunderstanding to worry about that.
Okay.
Because if the U.S. wanted to produce those things, we have them domestically. We don't produce them because we can just buy them cheaper from China. Mm-hmm. But if we wanted to produce them, you know, the U.S. government could subsidize it a little bit. And we could produce it at home, and it just really wouldn't like it's not like the stuff is only in China, right? But then you also have the example of in 2010, Japan and China got into a conflict, like a very minor, like fishing boat captain kind of conflict, right? Like somebody, you know, there was a fishing altercation and they captured a the Japanese captured a Chinese fisherman or something like this, and China stopped selling the rare earths. And Japan turned around and just bought rare earths from somebody else because China still had to sell them. So they sold it to some other person who then turned around and sold it to Japan, right? I mean, that's just sort of how markets work, right?
Yeah.
Plus, like, there's a lot of rare earth elements are done in these giant open pit mines that are illegal and that the Chinese government doesn't even know about. So there's like a huge black market for it. So like they couldn't even cut off all of the Chinese exports to Japan because there are like individual people in China running around digging the stuff out of pits and selling it on the black market, right? So like there's just, you know, prices went up a lot for a couple weeks, and within a month they were back to normal.
Okay.
Right. Even before, like, Japan didn't have to release the fishermen because it just didn't cause a conflict, right? Like, I mean, there was a conflict, but it didn't cause massive disruption. Yet, when policymakers looked at that, like no Japanese politician was happy about that situation. Like, nobody wants to be put in that situation. But the situation itself was not particularly threatening to Japan.
Okay.
Right. So yeah, all the resource competition, way, way exaggerated, at least from what we know from a political science standpoint. Doesn't happen that much, and markets adjust really well.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess another question I have is, if the U.S. is a net exporter, or almost like working to be a net exporter, then why do we import at all? And like, why do we engage with other countries in like the buying and selling if we have it at home?
So being that I'm trained as a political scientist, I'm an international relations person, and I'm a realist. And we talk about countries as if they do ABC, like as if they're unitary, solitary actors, right? And like, that's not even really what happens. It's not like the US decides, it's not like the US government is making these transactions, right? They're firms and businesses within the US, internationally, they're all just sort of acting for their own economic reasons, right? And yeah, it's interesting. If you look at, you know, there are some standard industry sources of data on trade flows and stuff. Like, the U.S. buys oil from Mexico and sells oil to Mexico. The U.S. buys oil from Canada and sells oil to Canada. Like, why do we do it that way? I have no idea. Like, we do it that way because some business somewhere decided, for whatever reason, it was cheaper for them to buy it from Canada than to buy it from Texas, right? And so all it's just the result of thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of market actors just doing what economically works the best for them. And so that's just sort of how it is, right? Like we might buy oil from Mexico, refine it here and sell it back as gasoline to Mexico because there are some companies that make money doing that, you know? And it surprises a lot of students when they show them the trade maps and you see these arrows that are going both directions between the U.S. and lots of other countries. Yeah, right. Because, if you were sort of sitting down and looking at it as a policymaker or thinking about, you know, but it's just those are the economic relationships that's just what the market gives us, right? And it's a free market. So,
yeah, true.
Yeah. So why not buy it? I mean, you know, it could be like, we're close to Canada. I know a guy there, you know, you've been dealing with the Canadians for 50 years. So we'll buy some oil from them instead of from somebody in North Dakota. You know, just, who knows, right?
Yeah.
Idiosyncratic.
Okay. This is very unrelated, but just because NDISC was in Hawaii recently and we heard a lot about like the Pacific Theater and like the Strait of Malacca and, you know, all this like conflict in like South China Sea and like East China Sea and all of that. Do you think that is a similar situation when you talk about like shipping routes in the grand scheme of things don't really matter, but control of these straits seems pretty significant?
Yeah. So it is analogous, I would say,
okay.
Right? It's pretty similar to the Red Sea, right? It's not the only way to get to China, right? If you want to take the shortest route, you can go through the Strait of Malacca, but you can go around. The U.S. wanted to cut off shipping to China through the Strait of Malacca, right? They could just go around.
Okay.
And it would cost a little more, and it would take a little longer, and they might need more tankers to do it because each tanker would have a longer route, like they'd have more time at sea, so maybe they'd have to build some tankers, but it's not going to be a big difference.
Okay. So when people talk about like China has a lot of advantages, but you know, their weakness is like we could hurt them economically. Can we? Like, it kind of seems like that might be overblown as well.
Well, you know, it's all about how how symmetrical or asymmetrical the interdependence is.
Okay.
Right? In some way, like, you can make arguments that we need them more than they need us, and you can make arguments that vice versa, mm-hmm. that they need that out. There's an old joke, I've never met a one-handed economist, right? So it's always like, well, on the one hand, but then on the other hand, right? So, you know, yeah, okay. Like, if the U.S. wanted to try to make it harder for China to get oil imports through, maybe they set up some kind of semi-blockade, maybe they use the Strait of Malacca, maybe they don't, right? But then that's going to cause a whole bunch of other problems, right? Then China's going to react, right? Mm-hmm. China might say, okay, well, all of the ships that are, you know, owned by Chinese companies, we're not going to let them deliver any goods to the United States, right? They could turn around and hurt us right back, right? And just maybe in a different way, mm-hmm. right? But these are two countries that are, you know, our economies are very interdependent, far more so than the U.S. and the Soviets ever were. And so it's a pretty interesting relationship, right? Like, yeah, we can hurt them, but they can hurt us. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, in that kind of situation, I tend to think it comes down to resolve. Who cares more, right?
Okay.
So, like, we could make things costly for them if they invade Taiwan. And they can make things costly for us if we try to help Taiwan. Who cares more about Taiwan, China or the United States? Mm. Definitely China, right? So ultimately, I think they're going to be willing to suffer higher costs than we are.
Okay.
Because Taiwan, to them, is a, you know, crucial national interest, right? They want it back by 2049. Mm-hmm. To us, Taiwan is a country that is democratic, and we'd like them to continue to be democratic, but they're thousands of miles away. And they're tiny, and they just don't really affect American security very much directly either way.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm looking at the situation and I'm China, mm-hmm. I'm probably feeling good in the sense that I doubt that the U.S. is willing to risk as much as I, China, am to get what I want in Taiwan.
Yeah.
Now, where they could be wrong is they might be wrong. China, like, and the U.S. might actually be willing to risk a lot.
It's like uncertainty of intention.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And that's part of what makes it such a dangerous situation, right? So, like, the U.S. might actually issue threats like, yeah, if you go into Taiwan, we're going to beat you back. And we might mean them. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese may not believe us.
Okay. Right? Yeah, it seems like there's a narrative that Taiwan is, like, a strategic national interest. But I'm not sure where that comes from. I'm not sure why people think that.
Yeah. So it can come from, like, and there are people who genuinely think that. There are mm-hmm. people who worry about the semiconductors factories in Taiwan mm-hmm. or whatever. I think that is overplayed because markets can adapt to that, mm-hmm. right?
So do you think it's like posturing for intention purposes?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, the strongest argument that people make is the credibility argument. Mm-hmm. So the U.S., you know, back in the 50s, essentially made nice with Taiwan and became allies with Taiwan. And if we ever break that alliance, people worry that U.S. credibility will be destroyed or harmed, right? That other allies will look at us and say, well, you said you defend Taiwan and then you cut them loose. So how do you know, like, how do we know that you're not going to cut NATO loose or you're not going to cut somebody, you know? And that's a possibility, right? I mean, how much are you willing to do just to protect your reputation, right? Is it smart for the United States to posture itself into a confrontation with China, I'm sorry, over Taiwan that could go nuclear? I mean, they're a nuclear country, just to protect our reputation, right?
Seems like what's happening.
It is what's happening. And to some people, that credibility issue is a huge issue.
Okay.
Right. I mean, on the one hand, yeah, our allies might doubt our credibility. Like, that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the more engaged we are in different areas of the world, the less freedom of action we have elsewhere. I mean, we're the big, mighty United States, but we only have so much time, money, military personnel, et cetera, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, if we put it out there for Taiwan, that can create opportunities for people to make mischief in other places potentially, right? So, like, you can't, I mean, ideally, you'd want to bluff everywhere mm-hmm. and never have to have your bluff called, right? It could potentially strengthen or make our allies that we do keep feel better because we don't have all these other commitments all over the world, right? Like, if we have fewer commitments that we think are stronger commitments, mm-hmm. that might be more credible than having a huge number of commitments that have never been changed, but some of them just aren't that important.
Mm-hmm. So like the future of U.S. grant strategy, what do you think it should look like? That's kind of a big question.
Yeah, it's a huge question. I mean, I don't think the United States needs to be the Middle East. I don't think we've needed to be there for a very long time. There's no great power threat to the Middle East. The countries there are strong enough that they can balance against each other. And ultimately, I think the U.S. should take the money that we invest in protect the Middle East and invest it in green energy so that we just don't need as much oil, period, regardless of where it's from. Because we got to do that for climate reasons anyway. And, you know, like we're essentially making it easier to destroy the climate by protecting this area that produces all this oil that then causes climate problems, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, why should we continue to do this? Like, why don't we take our military investment, put it in some other thing and just care less about the Middle East, be less dependent on oil? Mm-hmm. Europe, I don't know. I don't know that there's a big threat in Europe. Asia is an interesting question, right? Mm-hmm. China is potentially a threat to the United States. It's just so big and powerful. It's probably not a threat to mainland United States. Like, I'm not even sure the Soviets really were. But I would, you know, if you are uncertain about China's intentions and China's growing, getting more powerful, it makes sense, I think, to some extent, for the U.S. to try to balance China. And so, yeah, we should have a grand strategy that tries to balance China. I don't think we need to worry about the Middle East. I don't particularly think we need to worry about Europe. That would mean a sort of Asia-focused strategy. I don't think it makes sense for us to have a defense commitment to Taiwan. No offense to Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And I personally would feel awful if they got conquered by China and turned into a communist, you know, authoritarian regime, because I think that's probably a worse life for a lot of people in Taiwan. And that would make me sad personally. Mm-hmm. But I don't see a security interest, certainly not a direct one. The only arguments are the indirect arguments. Like, well, it doesn't hurt us directly, but other people might question our credibility. And I think that the U.S. has other ways of reassuring its allies that could compensate for any questions that arise.
Okay.
So I would think that we should back off the Taiwan thing, because to me, the idea that we could stumble into some war with China over a country that is not strategically important to us, that to me is pretty terrifying and doesn't seem like a good balance of interests.
Yeah. Right. Is that opinion, maybe it's just because we're at Notre Dame and there's, I don't know if it's a realist opinion or, but it seems like it's well represented at Notre Dame. Is it represented on the national scale?
No.
Okay.
It is. I mean, yes, it is. Like, we are in the nation and we're, you know, we have that opinion, but Notre Dame is not in the mainstream on this, right? Or not Notre Dame per se, but the faculty here at Notre Dame, we tend to be much more restraint focused in general. Most people in Washington, and I would say certainly academics that are international relations liberals, but even some realists disagree, right? There are realists that think, you know, just for the credibility reasons, you don't want to abandon Taiwan. And abandon is sort of a weighted term. But then the folks who are sort of IR liberals and want, you know, believe in the democratic peace and want democracy to spread and all of this, they very much want to keep the relationship with Taiwan. And politicians, there's not really, I don't think either party wants to get rid of this alliance. Like, Biden has made it closer, right? And Trump in general, you know, he's a little bit more circumspect in having allies. Like, he's less interested in having allies. He's less interested in the U.S. being involved in places all over the world. But he thinks China is the biggest. I mean, he hates China, right? Like, he thinks China is the biggest threat. And so I wouldn't be surprised if his, you know, like, if he supported having a defense commitment to Taiwan because he thinks China is just so big and bad and scary, right? So, like, I have not seen a political, you know, initiative at all to try to get the U.S. to end its commitment to Taiwan. It's just sort of, you know, a handful of realist academics in, you know, shouting into the abyss from the ivory tower.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Like I've not seen a lot of, you know, I haven't seen that view coming out in policy discussions mm-hmm. in Washington.
Okay.
Yeah, for the most part. So yeah. we're the outliers on it, which isn't to say that we're wrong, because mm-hmm. I actually think that,
no.
that, you know, to me it makes more sense, but there's also a whole wide range of views and lots of people think differently. And this is one where, you know, the majority is not of that view.
What happens in that situation? What do academics do about that when they like have an opinion
and nobody listens?
Yeah.
Most of them don't care.
Okay.
I mean, some of them do care and it's annoying and it's disheartening,
mm-hmm.
but our incentive structure as academics, you know, our, you know, if you're promoted to tenure or if you're promoted from tenure to full professor, you know, associate to full professor or whatever, it's all based on research that you publish in academic journals, and policymakers don't read academic mm-hmm. journals. And so it's just, you know, there's not a lot of, there's almost no incentive for academics to get involved in policy discussions. And those of us who do, we do it because it's something we care about and that we're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it even though it takes time away from ways that we could get ahead in our career. It doesn't actually help us get ahead in our career because academia is just sort of its own beast.
Mm-hmm.
And influence in that way of influencing public policy is not prized the same way that having a book that, you know, 300 people cite, like that's sort of the currency of the realm is scholarly citations, mm-hmm. not policy shout outs. You know, that's just sort of, we obey a different master.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a little bit off topic,
no,
but I was just wondering.
Yeah. No, not at all. I mean, you know, to me, I care about policy stuff and that's mm-hmm. important to me. And that a lot of people do care about it. And to me, I think it's unfortunate that universities, in some ways they care, but it's just, it's not how hiring decisions are made. It's not how promotion decisions are made. That's based on, are you publishing research in journals that people think are important journals?
Yes, no.
And some amount of teaching. Like,
okay.
Are you a decent teacher? If the answer is yes, you're probably good. If you're a terrible teacher, you might be in trouble. Right.
Okay.
But yeah, it's just not policy stuff.
Okay. Got it. In terms of your own research, do
yeah.
you have anything that you're working on?
Yeah, so I have a paper that it's in the early stages. In fact, calling it a paper is probably a bit of an overestimation or an exaggeration. It's like a thought process that is slowly becoming a paper. But I'm looking at, it's actually a policy question. So does China's investment in green energy technology threaten the United States? Yes or no,
mm-hmm.
right? And from an academic standpoint, when I talk to academics about it, most people are like, obviously not. And I sort of am of that view. But you talk to people in Washington and industrial policy is suddenly back. Like people are, Washington's been investing money in green energy stuff and saying we need to do this for national security reasons because we're competing with China mm-hmm. and China's going to get ahead on green energy investments. And so in the policy world, people are worried that somehow China investing in electric cars threatens American national security. And that's kind of taken as an axiomatic truth. Like mm-hmm. it's not particularly examined. And, you know, what's interesting about this, like there have been other industries in the past that, you know, competition over semiconductors, right? These are super important for electronics, you know, computers, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that was something during the Cold War that the U.S. worried about a lot, like the semiconductor industry and making sure the Russians didn't get our technology. And, you know, there are certain industries that the countries want domestically because either they have a direct national security consequence, like semiconductors does for, you know, advanced aircraft machinery, whatever, or because they do something that helps your economy grow faster. They have some kind of spillover effect in the economy. And that's sort of like the basis of something called strategic trade theory. But what's interesting about green energy is the spillover benefit that really matters is the global one, and it's positive, right? So like from America's perspective,
mm-hmm.
if China invests a bunch of money in EVs, right, then they're taking carbon out of the atmosphere and we get to benefit from that.
Yeah, it's the same air.
Right, yeah. Exactly. We benefit from it, even if we don't do any of it at all. So, I mean, we should be like, have at it, China, like go for it, mm-hmm. you know, yay, go green, you know, because they, right now it's costlier than fossil fuels. And so they're paying that upcharge, mm-hmm. like they're paying the extra cost to create those. And we're benefiting from it. Like we can free ride off of China. So we should be happy they're doing it, mm-hmm. right? And that to me is sort of like this really interesting, like, I don't understand why. Well, I have theories about why the U.S. is making it like a great power politics competition kind of issue with China. I mean, honestly.
It's like another technology race.
Yeah, like it's another technology race, but it's, you know, it's not a technology that's going to give them some kind of military advantage. It's mm-hmm. not. I mean, these, you know, fossil fuels are way superior in performance for military stuff. And that's just going to be the case, right? So, you know, it's not like they're developing some new technology that's going to leave us behind on the battlefield. Instead, they're developing a new technology that, you know, cleans our air, right? I say, hooray, you're hooray, right? So, you know, I think what I actually think is going on is partly that, you know, people in the Biden administration, they want to support green energy for climate reasons, but that's not politically popular. But sticking it to China is politically popular. Mm-hmm. So if you can turn it into a narrative of, well, China's making technological progress and we don't want to be left behind. We want to outperform them. We want to outcompete them. Then that gives you a non-climate change rationale for investing in these things.
Okay.
And so I think it's all sort of a political stunt. Mm. Well, I don't want to say stunt, but it's a political reason that they're using that terminology. But I, you know, again, I went to a conference about a month ago, talked about a bunch of these issues, and I think people really are actually, there is some amount of actual security. They're like, there's fear. Like, what if China corners the market in solar panels? Oh no, you know, that's going to be a threat to the U.S.
And it's not like,
I don't think it works that way.
Okay.
For a whole bunch of reasons. Uh-huh. So, but anyway, that was a long-winded description, but that's the paper that I'm currently working on. Yeah.
One like just follow-up question to that.
Yeah.
Is, do you think that China's transition to green energy is being overplayed? Because people are motivated for the U.S. to transition to green energy?
Maybe. I mean, it is genuinely like they're investing a lot of money in it. So
I've read they're like, you know, to 2060, they want to be like totally green or something like that. Like they're trying to be like.
Yeah.
The
carbon neutral.
Yeah, exactly. Like the quickest turnaround that the world's ever seen. Something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know the particulars on that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they are genuinely investing a lot in green energy. And that is consequential. I think where it's overplayed is to assume that there's some kind of nefarious security consequences of that. Mm-hmm. But there are actors that have an incentive to play up that story, like politicians that want to look like they're doing something mm-hmm. or that want to promote green energy for green reasons, but don't want to say that. Or, you know, if you're a business person and you want to start a semiconductor, mm-hmm. you know, business in the United States, you're going to go and tell the president, like, China's beating us in semiconductors and it's going to cause all these terrible security problems. So invest money in us, right? Like subsidize us, give us tax breaks, right? Okay. So there's always going to be market actors that play up that lens mm-hmm. for their own bottom line.
Okay.
But yeah,
that sounds fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. I'll let you know what I find. I mean, I have to go into it with an open mind. Like maybe it does have security consequences that I don't understand. Right. Like mm-hmm. I don't want to, I haven't decided, but I'm skeptical about it.
Okay.
And I haven't seen academic work that really takes it seriously. So that's what I want to do.
Wow. Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. All right. I think we are good to wrap up.
This has been awesome. And I really have enjoyed talking with you. And
well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure. And happy to do it again in the future.